He's become a figure of fun, and he's certainly ripe to be mocked. From his haircut to his baby face, North Korean despot Kim Jong-un is a dream for cartoonists, satirists and comedians. But we shouldn't let the laughter get in the way of the fact that he's a dangerous, sinister dictator with a lot of deadly toys at his disposal, probably the most frightening of which are long-range missiles. The experts say it's only a matter of time before we come into the range of those missiles. So what can we do about it? Can we and should we have a missile defence system? And how much protection would it really afford us? Joining me now to talk about just that is Dr. Stefan Freuling, Senior Lecturer in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at ANU. He was also a member of the External Expert Panel on the 2015 Defence White Paper. Stefan, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you.
Well, it's an ugly, ugly thing to imagine, isn't it? Australia being subject to a missile attack. But history might not show us, but recent events show us that that's a possibility now, where it might not have been considered a possibility 20 or 30 years ago.
That's certainly true. It's a possibility that's been brought onto the front pages by the recent North Korean tests. In Europe, you had a very similar experience over the last few years with Iranian missile tests. But the exposure of Australia and other countries to ballistic missiles actually goes back many decades. During the Cold War, we know that the Soviets had nuclear missiles targeted at Australia. In the 1960s, Australia went through a very similar scare when China, which was the rogue state of its day, developed a nuclear weapon and was working on ballistic missiles. So the fact that Australia is vulnerable to nuclear missiles has been with us for a number of decades. But it is true that the number of countries that can target Australia is increasing, and certainly North Korea is on everybody's minds in that regard these days.
Hmm. You've done a paper in The Interpreter from the Lowy Institute, and I've read that, and you mentioned the business of Russia and China. I was probably so young then that I don't remember now whether they were regarded as rogue states, as North Korea now is, as well, whether their leadership was regarded as sufficiently unstable or erratic as people now regard the North Korean leader. Do you have any insight into that? I don't.
Well, certainly China in its day was. I mean, if you go back to the early 1960s, China was still under Mao Zedong. It was in the midst of the Cultural Revolution, and that kind of state developing nuclear weapons and ballistic missile technologies raised a lot of concerns and even led the United States to develop a limited national missile defense system and field it for a while in the late 1960s. So I think that there are some parallels. Whether the parallels will hold into the future remains to be seen, in the sense that if you look at the Chinese and the Russian nuclear arsenals, the West kind of learned to live with those on the basis of a common understanding that nuclear weapons threats are best met with nuclear deterrence, that you, if you like, create an equilibrium of deterrence and thereby try to neuter those threats. But that obviously assumes a certain rationality and other functions on the other side. And so one of the concerns that we have with the North Koreans is whether we can rely on the rationality and the robustness of the North Korean regime to enter into a similar relationship.
Indeed. It's not very encouraging news, but it is probably news to most people who, like me, when you think of being attacked by a big missile, you imagine deaths in very, very, very significant numbers, tens and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, you imagine. But that's not your assessment, is it?
Well, a lot of things depend, obviously, on what is on the missile, how reliable that missile is. What we know about the North Korean missile program so far is that they would struggle to reach northern Australia. It's true that they've made a lot of progress over the last 20, 30 years in their missile program, progressively pushing the range of their missiles further out. But they're still quite away from a reliable missile, in the sense that the North Koreans need to be able to actually get the missile off the ground without it being destroyed beforehand. They need to make sure that it doesn't fail in flight, that the warhead survives the re-entry, and that it then actually lands anywhere close to the area where they were trying to target, rather than dozens of kilometers away. So far, they are quite a way away from reliably achieving those factors. So in that sense, it's the political effect of them demonstrating the intent of these capabilities and the uncertainty how close they actually are. But that uncertainty exists for the North Koreans as well. This is, in that sense, the North Koreans will probably for a long time and maybe always be quite different from the major powers like the United States, Russia, China, France and Britain, who have the technical capabilities to develop missiles where there's fairly little uncertainty about the effect that they could actually achieve.
Mm. But you make some comments about the population distribution in Australia, and I didn't find it very encouraging that you thought the fatalities would be closer to the upper four-digit figures. So what are we talking? Less than 10,000. Rather than hundreds of thousands. But, you know, a missile attack that killed 5,000 people is still a very, very dramatic
thing. It's a very dramatic thing, and I wouldn't put too much store, but I wouldn't want to be pinned down on what the casualties would be, because obviously it depends on the particulars. But I think that if you look historically at the way that Australia has thought about nuclear weapons, we've perceived ourselves as one of the most vulnerable societies vulnerable Western societies. And this goes back to the Australian debates about whether or not, for example, we should sign the non-proliferation treaty back in the late 1960s. And the judgment there was that the Australian population is very concentrated in the capital cities. We don't have, whereas if you look at European countries, for example, a much greater part of the population is distributed in smaller cities. And if you look at thermonuclear weapons, which are the hydrogen bomb, those weapons, the city busters, I guess, of Cold War lore, those weapons would have had the capability to really completely destroy large urban areas. What we're looking at with the North Korean nuclear arsenal are pure fission, atomic bombs, like early generation weapons that from the engineering challenges are much simpler than thermonuclear weapons, which don't have that capability. So if you look at probably the best historical analogy of what the North Koreans are looking at is something like the Hiroshima bomb, about 15 to 20 kilotons. And those weapons have effects over a diameter of 3.5, 4, 5 kilometers in that order of magnitude, which obviously, if you look at an Australian city, is quite different from the dozens of kilometers of complete destruction that you could have achieved with a Russian or Chinese missile.
Mm. Well, I don't know that that's terribly encouraging, but I note some element of encouragement in it.
Yes.
Now, for people like me that aren't, defence specialists, what are the different types of missiles that are available, and they might require different types of defence, mightn't they? Can we just deal with them in the large generic categories?
Yeah, in terms of the ballistic missiles that could be a potential threat to Australia or its forces, one of the important things to remember is the range of those missiles over which they fly. Relatively short-range missiles spend most of their time in the atmosphere, and they're also comparatively slow. And so they're much more easy to intercept than intercontinental range ballistic missiles, who essentially go very much straight up into space, spend most of their travel in the depth of space, and then re-enter the atmosphere at very high speeds. So obviously, from a technical point of view, you need quite different interceptors if you want to shoot down those different missiles. And in particular, shooting down intercontinental ballistic missiles requires interceptors that destroy the incoming missile in space. And that's very different, a very different technology in many ways.
And very expensive.
And very expensive technology from other interceptors that are more kind of outgrowths of air defense missiles, where you develop an a missile that's primarily designed to shoot down aircraft, and then progressively that missile has been upgraded and so on, and given the capability to intercept ballistic missiles in the atmosphere. And that's kind of like the iconic system is Patriot that people remember from the first Gulf War. Those missile systems obviously are much more prevalent, to some extent cheaper, and much more versatile than the systems that would be required to intercept a true long-range intercontinental ballistic missile.
Mm. And there's been examples around the world, haven't there, where missiles don't have to be launched from some sort of bunker. You know, if you think back to the Kennedy days when they were using eyes in the sky to watch the lids coming off bunkers and missiles coming out, Now they can be launched off ships in the ocean, so there's a much harder to detect where your risk is coming from. And in fact, in North Korea's case, they're quite mobile. That's good for them in one sense, but risky in another. But that's not something I think most people appreciate, the degree to which there's mobility in the launching of these missiles. It's not just from one launch pad hidden somewhere in North Korea or in Russia or China. It can be almost anywhere.
Yes, that's true. I mean, ultimately, if you are a country that owns ballistic missiles, one of your challenges is to how do you prevent those missiles from being destroyed by your adversary before they even leave the ground? And embedding them in very heavy fortified silos is one way of doing that. Hiding them under the seas on submarines is another. And giving them a certain amount of mobility so that the adversary doesn't know where they are is another. And you can put them on rails, as the Russians are doing, or have them road mobile, as is the preferred solution nowadays in Russia, in China, in North Korea. But that mobility isn't a panacea. They don't become invulnerable. Certainly, it is. The United States has mounted a very significant effort and has a lot of experience of tracking those mobile missiles dating back to the Soviet mobile missile forces during the Cold War, because ultimately those missiles still need logistics support. They need to have, for example, in the current North Korean missile cases, they need to actually be refueled before launch. They need meteorological support to know where the wind is blowing, I mean, literally down to those kinds of things. And those generates kind of like signatures that you can track with electronic warfare aircraft, with reconnaissance satellites and so on, to try and know where these missiles are at any one point in time.
Mm.
So in that sense, the vulnerability of these missiles remains.
Sure. We're speaking with Dr. Stefan Freuling, Senior Lecturer in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at ANU. He was also a member of the expert panel on the 2015 Defence White Paper. And what we're talking about is Australia potentially being subject to attack by missiles and trying to find out a bit about it, because if you're like me, you don't know much about it. Stefan, as I say, thanks again for joining us. Now, we were talking about the mobility of these things and the savvy that the United States has in tracking where they're moving to and all the supports that they need. You don't just drag a missile out on the back of a truck and, you know, press a button. You need lots of technical support to get your target right, to understand about the weather, all the sorts of things you mentioned. Now, doesn't that create a vulnerability that might be a way that Australia can look to defending itself from missile attack? In other words, instead of thinking we will shoot it down, work on getting at them before they go because of all the technology that's on the ground.
That is correct. And I think we need to, the ultimate aim is to make sure that the adversary's missile attack fails. And that doesn't necessarily require us to shoot down the missile. And in many ways, that's some of the most complicated and complex way of foiling that attack. And definitely destroying a missile before it leaves the ground is a way in which is much more amenable to use of, if you like, general purpose military forces, a fighter bomber aircraft of the types that Australia has, an electronic warfare aircraft, intelligence support, I mean, overhead imagery. If you net those together, if you practice tracking these missiles, Australia has already capabilities to contribute to such a counter-missile campaign, if you like, conceived in the broader sense. One thing that remains, though, is that whether you look at shooting down a missile or trying to address missiles by trying to destroy them before they leave the ground, it's a campaign where Australia would have to work with allies. Australia would have to look at how do we fit into a broader campaign, probably led by the United States. And if you conceive of the problem in that sense, there are already things that Australia can do as part of a kind of contribution to a missile defense campaign. And there are capabilities beyond interceptors that are quite useful in that endeavor.
Mm. Well, partnerships really are important in the business sector, in politics, and we all understand in defense, very much so for Australia. Are there any difficulties for us? I mean, it is clear as a bell that our greatest ally is the United States. But what about other countries at a lower level than the United States? Are there opportunities for us to work with them as well?
Yeah, there's a whole range of countries that Australia can work with in this regard, in particular insofar as we look at the defense against shorter range missiles. I mean, if you like an extension of air defense, if you like the threat, for example, from maybe Iranian missiles that our forces are exposed to in the Middle East, for example, those kinds of missiles are, there's a lot of activity going on in European NATO members, for example, in Japan, in looking at how to deal with those missiles and how countries can cooperate. And to a large extent, that relies on finding ways to technically exchange information between sensor systems, between radars, for example, that are in the area that might pick something up and that are then able to alert whatever missile interceptors are in the theater and that could have a shot at shooting these down. So there are a lot of exchanges already and a lot of scope for partnerships at the technical level that also extend to the political level of how to manage like international agreements around the control of missile technology, support to the sanctions regime against North Korea, even that ultimately are part of a broader political military strategy to dealing with the missile threat.
Yeah.
So it is not just the United States, although the United States obviously has a critical technical role in the Western world.
Sure. Now, Stefan, is it unfair to say that the image we get of the North Korean leader is of a spoilt boy, spoilt all his life, who just loves all these big military toys and brings them out, but that responding to that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to go out and get another air warfare destroyer, because we'd only get one and where would we place it? That there are many, many other ways that we could put that money into effective, or as equally effective, missile defence for Australia. The sorts of things you've mentioned, more cooperative activities with other countries, greater intelligence, perhaps a greater focus on our Air Force and its capabilities to get at things before they leave the ground. Do you have a view there about which way Australia ought to go?
Look, I think there's actually very little that Australia can do on its own or through its own policies to manage intercontinental missile threat from North Korea. I think what we need to look to is to support the efforts of the countries that are much more directly affected and that have much greater influence on the situation, particularly the United States, China, Japan, and South Korea. So to a large extent, this is about political support to the ongoing efforts of those countries. There are a few things that Australia could do to strengthen its, the missile defense capabilities in the ADF itself, and certainly a new air warfare destroyer, which would have the ability to shoot to employ certain missile defense interceptors, the SM-3, is something that has often been mentioned. It would be, in many ways, a sensible step to get in gaining experience with the use of interceptors, but having one ship with a handful of interceptors is not going to be a panacea to the threat or even a significant change. It would really, that ship would have to be at this same, in the right spot at the right time. And so it's more about giving the ADF progressively greater role in this area and gaining experience and having progressively more and more to bring to an overall allied campaign, rather than Australia kind of having one acquisition and solving the problem.
Might be a case for getting more interchanges between other defence forces that have the capacity and that can train our guys. In any event, Stefan, look, thanks very much for joining us today. It's you see these things on the television, you think, what about us? And it's handy to have someone like you who knows a lot about it to share that knowledge with us. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
We've been speaking to Dr. Stefan Froehling, Senior Lecturer in the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU.